Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Henry Rees-Sheridan.
On the show today, fashion, gender, and how the two can empower one another. Journalist and author Sally Howard will be here to talk about her contribution to the photo exhibition Les Sapeurs, the Lady Dandies of the DRC.
We'll also be learning why treating yourself to a cocktail doesn't have to mean waking up with a hangover the next day. Cook and author of new non-alcoholic cocktail book Dry, Claire Liardet, will be with us later.
And we'll be keeping things dry, or free of rain anyway, with a chat about the history of the humble umbrella. Author Marion Rankin will be discussing her book Brolyology at the end of the show.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Bill Luty will try and forecast some of next week's big news, and we'll spin some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Another week bites the dust, Henry. Here you and I are sharing our Sunday roast lunch together around the table of Studio One at Midori House in London.
I'm particularly excited to interview, if that is the word, Bill Luty.
Really?
For the NLA, the news look ahead, in a few seconds. It's my first time on the other side of the transom, so to speak. How am I going to handle myself? How is he going to handle himself?
I've got an idea. Let's find out right now.
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way you going, Billy? Can I go with you?
Welcome, Bill Luty. What's on the agenda next week?
Hello, there's plenty going on.
Has this upset your sense of equilibrium in the universe?
I don't know where I am. Should I ask you questions? Should you ask me? It's confusing, isn't it?
I'll let you start.
Okay, well, should we head to the US?
Okay.
Let's do it.
Mayoral elections are taking place across the country, but all eyes are on New York. The mayoral election there is being watched particularly closely, obviously since the attack this week. Some people are asking, how much of an effect will that have on the result? The current mayor, Bill de Blasio, is running for the second time up against the Republican Nicole Malliotakis. And there's also Beau Dietl. I like him. He's an independent candidate.
Bill, I've been slightly befuddled by the hoo-ha, I'll call it that, around this race, because my understanding is that it is an almost dead cert foregone conclusion. And I know people are saying, oh, the terror attacks that have happened recently might change it, but they're not going to, are they? De Blasio is leagues ahead. Am I wrong, Tom?
So I think what we're asking you, Bill, is if we're looking at Beau Dietl's chances of success, would you give Beau diddly?
Yeah. To bring this back...
Please do.
Yes, Bill de Blasio is like 40 points ahead in most of the polls.
40?
Last time when
Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg was running
Mickey.
For re-election, this was just off the back of September 11th, and obviously he came out and was incredibly strong and said all of the right things. It boosted him into his second term. Obviously, Bill de Blasio is already in the lead. If he acts the right way, which people are saying he is, maybe that will increase his lead. So I think you're right, yeah, he's going to win.
But he's in a bit of an Abe situation too, because he is paradoxically, if that is the right word, deeply unpopular among the residents. There simply aren't any other options.
So Bill, where should we head next?
We're going to go to a number of Asian countries with Donald Trump, the President of the United States of America. He'll be visiting Japan, Korea, China, Vietnam and the Philippines all in one busy week. He'll be looking to get a bit more love back off Xi Jinping. Obviously, when we saw him in Mar-a-Lago, he was like, I love Xi Jinping. He's a great guy. He's a businessman. He knows all these things.
We've had the Chinese Party Congress since then, though, hasn't we? Things have changed for Donald.
And Xi is up there. Donald Trump, not so much. I think he's going to be looking to get a bit of that brotherly love back.
He may have his work cut out. It's classic Trump, isn't it? On tour, he does it infrequently. The dynamics of the kind of welcome he gets or doesn't get will be interesting in each of those locations.
Certainly, particularly given the delicacies, obviously, of etiquette in a completely different culture. You know, I can only imagine that Trump will offend almost every pre-existing sensibility there is in that neighbourhood of the world, although he seems to do that in most places he goes,
well,
including his own culture.
He's put a coat of primer down by offending everyone before he's even left.
Yeah. So maybe he's pre-baited.
Maybe that's a clever diplomatic strategy, to get your offence in early and often.
Are you going to become one of these people who attributes a greater degree of kind of strategic sophistication to the Donald than he warrants?
Definitely not.
Okay.
What's quite weird is while he's in Vietnam, Vladimir Putin might be there as well, and they might just have a side meeting. It's like when you've got two friends and you know they don't really get on and you've invited them around on the same afternoon and there might be a bit of crossover.
I always find the old marginal bilateral quite interesting, though.
Marginal bilateral? Is that the technical term or something you just invented?
It's a technical
term. Okay.
Little from column A and a little from column B.
Bill, do we have one more?
We've got one more, and we're staying in Asia. China, specifically. On Saturday, it's Singles Day.
Single people?
Yeah.
This is a huge, huge thing.
It's absolutely massive. It's like Valentine's Day, but rather than for couples, it's for singles. It's because it's the 11th of the 11th, 1111.
Numerology can play an important role in that neck of the woods.
And there are some extraordinary social phenomena. I know, for example, that there are a lot of people who... Is this right? But is this when people hire...
Yeah, hire girlfriends.
Boyfriends, even husbands and wives, to play the role so they're not single on Singles Day?
And you take them home to your parents and you're like, this is my significant other, and they're like, oh, that's very good, but they're not, they've just been hired. It's supposed to be a day to celebrate being single. It's supposed to grab being single and say, this is great. But they also do these strange things. They're apparently that people have like singles parties where they bring all their single friends around, and it's like a bit of like a blind date day.
So sorry, just to clarify, it's meant to, because I always understood it, I've never been able to separate the Chinese single day from obviously the demographic phenomenon of there being gender imbalances because of the one child policy. My understanding was that it was a kind of imposed as a way to alleviate some of the demographic pressures caused by that. But you're saying it's almost like Mother's Day, for example, or Father's Day, but for single people. It's kind of a celebration of singledom.
It's for single people to do what they want. If those single people want to celebrate being single, they can. If they want to use that day to stop being single, they can do that.
I like it.
As with all things in the world ever, businesses, companies have seen this and been like, hey, we've got some money to make here. So online shopping goes through the roof. Cinemas are packed, karaoke booths full to the ceiling.
What kind of tat are the suits peddling now to singles?
I've absolutely no idea.
Okay, you haven't got an example. Could you think of a product that would be successfully marketed specifically to a single person?
I can think of a few, but I'm not sure that's an avenue we want to go down on a Sunday lunchtime. Perhaps we should leave it there, Henry. Bill Lutie, thank you for looking ahead to next week today. Sally Howard is a journalist and author whose work covers topics ranging from travel to women's rights and gender studies. She last joined us on the Monocle Weekly a few years ago now to discuss her illuminating book, The Kama Sutra Diaries, which looked at attitudes towards sexuality across India. And she's back today to talk about a new exhibition of work at London's Brunel Gallery from Kinshasa-based photographer Junia D. Khanna, Les Sapeurs, the Lady Dandies of the DRC, with words provided by Sally.
As the title suggests, Sally and Junia have been documenting the subculture of the Sapeurs, independent women in the Democratic Republic of Congo who have adopted and stamped their identity on male-oriented flamboyant clothing styles. The male dandies are known as Sapeurs.
There we are. She joins us now to tell us about how clothing and fashion can influence society. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, Sally. Very good to have you.
Hello. Nice to be back with
us. I guess, actually, some people may be familiar now with the depictions of Sapeurs.
The male Sapeurs.
The male iteration. I guess it tells us something interesting that, indeed, there is a female one, that's now being recorded. Yeah. Maybe you can tell us why one is more prominent still than the other. I fear I may know the answer, but maybe you can start with that.
Yes, well, there's the obvious answer, but there's also the fact that it sort of stems from colonial resistance movement. It was dressing in the master's clothes, so it was houseboys who adopted the clothes in Brazzaville, actually, the neighbouring city, under the colonial times, and often the houseboys were paid in clothing. And then it became part of L'Amicale, which is a colonial resistance movement that's sort of set up in Paris. So a lot of the original sapeurs were part of this colonial resistance movement. And there was this 1980s male sapeur movement that had rumba stars, very sort of colourful rumba stars that were at the front of it. This guy called Papa Wemba, who dressed in white suits and monochrome spats, very colourful. And a guy who set up a religion called the clothing or Katende religion, who's now celebrated every year. So it's very much a kind of masculine tradition. And the sapeurs that seem to have come up in the past 5 to 10 years, who originally sort of started as an offshoot, but now seem to have a variety of motivations. So some of them want to pass as gender non-conforming or queer in a very sort of homophobic country. Some sort of cite it as a feminist movement in the kind of Western chalk. And others just want to sort of celebrate their economic liberation, because a lot of the women are clothing importers or work in local markets and import these clothes, because all the clothes they wear are imported, you know, quite expensive brands from Paris and often from Belgium. So it's a sort of former colonial bloc of the area of the equatorial Africa. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
And is it explicitly political then? I mean, I sense from what you say that it kind of is. I mean, maybe there are some people who are just celebrating this certain kind of flamboyance, and you mentioned there's a celebration of economic freedom, but it's hard to get away, of course, from some pretty heavyweight issues, whether they're post-colonial or explicitly political in terms of gender equality and that kind of thing. Can you separate politics from this sort of phenomenon?
I don't think you can, but I think you have to be very careful of overwriting our interpretation onto it, and especially in terms of feminism, because you hear Congo and you think violence against women, you know, it's got the highest rate of rape in the world, 400,000 cases a year. So it's very facile to see it from the outside and say, yes, this is liberation, empowerment. And especially when recently, a couple of weeks ago, there was a Gloria Steinem and Lena Dunham fronted campaign to sort of liberate women from sexual oppression in the Congo. And you have to be very careful. But I think you can definitely see part of the regaining of a pre-colonial femininity. You know, a lot of women talk about this femininity that was basically all the sort of strong female roles that were suppressed by colonial rule that impressed this very sort of churchy, very historical mode of being for females onto women in this area. So, yeah, I think there's a sort of reclaiming, and also a reclaiming that's going on in terms of sort of cultural and youth, and, you know, the youth of the area too, something to be proud of, I suppose. Junior said that when he was photographing one of our women, Queen of the Uprising, she called herself, a man stopped him on the street and said, women should go to the market and earn money for their families. They shouldn't wallow in the street like rogues. Which is a pretty kind of typical response, you know, you women shouldn't be doing this. And a couple of the women themselves, their children were very churchy, very religious, and disapproved of how their mothers dressed. So it's a very kind of patchy thing, but I think, you know, quite a lot of people support them.
How do sapeurs, male and female, arrange themselves socially?
So there are sort of groups, sapeur and sapeurs groups. There's a prominent group called the Leopards. So they form different chapters, and you get women's groups that are sort of offshoots of these chapters. And then you also get sort of separate sapeurs groups that are kind of informal networking groups.
Can you dabble in sapeur lifestyle, or do you have to sign up? Is it like being a Hell's Angel where you have to be kind of a full member or nothing at all, or can you kind of be halfway and halfway, or test it out a little bit?
I think you could just buy yourself a top hat and a cane and declare yourself a sapeur. I don't think you necessarily have to be part of the machinery of these organisations, but I think for a few of the women I met, this is a living for them as well, because people compete at competitions. They still sort of very central to the rumba music is sapeurism, so there's full time living to be made from it too. So yes, of course there are dabblers, but it is pretty expensive. So you need economic or access to imported clothes.
On that note, I'm interested. Obviously, both Congo and the DRC are quite poor countries. A lot of people living in poverty on less than $1 a day. For me, it's just interesting to observe that even in those environments of relative scarcity, where people will not be accustomed to a lot of the luxuries that we enjoy in more economically developed countries, and apparently quite a significant portion of the population do prioritise getting hold of fashion and expressing themselves through fashion. Have you found that to be the case everywhere that you've looked through your kind of gender studies lens?
Not particularly, no. I mean, I think this is a very specific subculture. I mean, I think perhaps in Thailand you have female tomboys who very much use kind of gender ambivalent clothing as their mark or their way of means of expression. But I think this is quite unique in being flamboyant and quite, you know, I mean, to some people, yes, it's jarringly munted when you sort of, you know, the streets aren't paved and people are there. I mean, the women look amazing. They wear these huge capes and these silver canes, and it's quite jarring to some. But I think that's the point of it, actually. That's the sort of locus of the pride is, look, you know, we've got nothing around us, but look at how we dress. This is our pride.
I think it's really interesting if we sort of take a step back and look at fashion and clothing and particularly sort of quite pronounced styles of dress and look at how they come to symbolise movements. I mean, I guess if we look around the world, it's quite telling, isn't it, that fashion is often a forum, the way people dress. It's often quite a direct way to broadcast one's sensibilities about a political issue, this kind of thing. Again, I wonder, is there ever a laziness maybe in media or in certain quarters about the analysis of that, the quality of the analysis? Or do you think actually there's quite robust discussions and it's quite interesting to reflect on how people assess the meaning of what other people are wearing?
Yes. I mean, I think it's all part of our obsession with identity politics now and the sort of expression of the self and the individual. And yes, it was quite interesting to me because this began as a feature, the huge take-up and the response to it, and how people want quite simplistically these good-looking, very visual representations of an upbeat culture that comes from a place that's usually sort of seen as sort of impoverished or war-torn. So, yes, it's a bit of a complicated picture, but I think, you know, we are also fixated by the same things that the sappers are, aren't we, these days? We all want to kind of express ourselves as an individual. So I think it's part of that. And I think, yeah, there probably is a bit of an unsavoury Western media obsession with such things. You see it in Japan too.
So you cover gender studies, women's rights quite broadly as a journalist. Is there a part of the world that you would like to cover from the angle that perhaps listeners won't be aware of in terms of interesting gender dynamics going on there?
I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of stuff in terms of antiquated gender nonconformity that isn't really covered. The sworn virgins of Albania that have been covered a little bit, but they haven't had too much coverage. You know, at puberty decide to live as a man, and you have all of these. And there's obviously a lot of interest in these marginal subcultures, and especially the hijra in India. They're endlessly consumed. But I think we're beginning to realise now how many of these sort of different expressions of sort of gender nonconformity there are, and actually how damaging the kind of Western gay model has been in some countries, where it's obliterated other versions of gender nonconformity and other versions of sexual expression.
Well, on that point, how I don't know, sidetracked do the really important narratives in this space get by either, you know, politicians or maybe even some well-meaning, well-intentioned people who don't understand the nuances riding in? And we get examples like in the US with this thing about, you know, how a bathroom's branded, and it blows up into this massive political hot potato. And one worries that significant narratives that would actually benefit people in the longer term aren't even being discussed. And then it gets parked for a while. Is that a problem? Again, is it media driven that we lose track of the substance because we're just looking at a headline or one big row over one distracting issue?
Yeah, it is an issue, and especially with the kind of transgender moment that, you know, is still sort of rumbling on. I did a piece that became a project for the Royal Academy of Dance on ballet as a site of transgender transition, and people are attracted to that sort of very binarised male-female form. And, you know, there's a problem with it. There's a problem with how people bridle at the sort of idea of transgender transition, as I think people did with the sort of peak of homophobia in the 40s and 50s. It was somehow equated with perversion. And you definitely have that reaction at the moment with transgenderism. And you see that by extension with a sort of conservative reaction in the States to bathrooms. I think, you know, trans people are becoming much more vocal, and I think, yeah, we're definitely an inflection point for the trans community.
It's almost endlessly fascinating, Sally, to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming to see us. That's Sally Howard and Les Sapeurs, the Lady Dandies of the DRC, is at SARS's Brunei Gallery in London until the 16th of December.
That's it.
There you go, 16th of December. Plenty of time to pay a visit, Sally. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. What's that I can smell in the air? Oh, it's a fast-approaching tune on the Monocle Weekly.
What are we going to listen to, Tom?
Henry, you may remember from a few months back, we enjoyed something from Philadelphia four-piece Palm. This is brand new. It's from the forthcoming album Rock Island. Let's listen to Pearly.
That was Palm from the US with Pearly. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. When a new book of cocktail recipes landed on our desks here at Midori House, obviously Tom and myself selflessly put ourselves forward to to test them all.
But the drinks we're sampling today are different, Henry, from your usual tipple, in that they don't actually contain the ingredient that many might think is indispensable for the kind of midday drink that I know, Henry, you like in particular, alcohol. Claire Liardette is author of Dry, the non-alcoholic cocktail book, and she's here to tell us how to make a couple of them. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Claire. Now, I guess it is a warm welcome, and yet there are some who would say, no, don't welcome Claire. She's ruining cocktails for us by taking out the booze. But we're here to, I guess, completely disprove the notion that actually you lose by losing the alcohol. And maybe that's the starting point. How much of this is a celebration of the cleverness and the tastiness and the delight that exists outside of alcohol town?
Yes, well, I agree. One of the problems that I have had when you don't have alcohol is you lose any sort of depth or complexity or interest in a drink. Mm. And that's very much what I tried to play with, actually, in this. And also, we were talking just earlier about how people have a fear of cocktails. I was introducing the idea of the film Cocktail, Tom Cruise and all the sort of shaking and the bottles and all the sort of stuff, and it's all quite scary. And actually, it just needn't be. It's just a way of mixing some flavours together. You can use a jam jar, you can use a chopstick. So really the book is about sort of pushing the boundaries and saying, try different things, put some herbs in, make herb syrups, you know, taste it if you don't like it, take that bit out. And generally try and make them more friendly.
Claire, what was your motivation for putting together a compendium of non-alcoholic cocktails in the first place? Was it a personal interest? Was it because there's a demand out there for this kind of thing?
I think a bit of both, actually. I obviously have had two children, so I've had enforced non-drinking for quite long periods of time. I've always been in the sort of hospitality world in different ways, so I've gone out to drink a lot and felt there was nothing there for me. Mm. I mean, I literally would drink fizzy water. Nowadays, I think the thing is it's changed a lot. There's more coming, especially in big cities. So it was a mixture of that and a mixture of sort of feeling that I didn't want to be a second-class citizen. I wasn't drinking.
I feel we should on with the demonstration. And I right. should say that we've had some extraordinary sort of demonstrations here on the Monocle Weekly down the years. Never have I been quite as excited by the array of things, the wealth of options before us. There's all sorts. So shall we commence? And you're going to sort of talk us through some of the, well, what we hope are actually relatively straightforward processes.
Exactly. So the first one I'm doing is in a cocktail shaker, but it's just to sort of mix the drinks up. And it's quite an autumnal one. It's pear and rosemary on the rocks.
Perfect. Because let's be honest, it's a bit brisk out in London town, isn't it? A little grey.
Right. So I'm pouring about 60 mil. I mean, the recipes are in the book as a guide. So that was 60 mils of pear juice. Get a good quality cloudy one. And then 30 mils of lemon juice. Freshly squeezed.
At this juncture, Claire, I'll ask you, I'm a vegetarian. I tend to avoid meat substitute foods. So I don't like them because I don't like the idea that they're trying to be meat.
Yes.
Rather than just eating, a delicious vegetable dish. With regard to these cocktails, is the aim to get them to resemble as closely as possible in flavour profile, in drinking experience, proper hard cocktails? Or are they meant to be a separate thing?
Well, I think they're a mix, actually. So interesting enough, this is a separate one, I would have said. And then the one I'm going to do next is one of my favourite drinks, is a Negroni. And I really missed that sort of bitter flavour. I've never, ever had... I mean, fruit juice and soda water just doesn't do it for me. And so with this, what is interesting about this is a sugar syrup. So this is rosemary sugar syrup, which is a really easy way to make sugar syrup. Equal amounts of sugar and water. And then you just simmer the herb for about 10 minutes. So you can play. You can make sage ones, thyme ones, all sorts of things. And you can make small amounts. And what this does is it gives you this lovely sort of woody, aromatic background. Mm. And actually fresh rosemary is just wonderful, not like dried at all. So that goes in there. Ice.
That's a good sound, isn't it? You can't hear it, but we can.
This is very much the soundtrack to my working day.
Indeed.
A bit of shaking. That just helps to mix up the syrup. And then I'm not straining it.
Now, I imagine you have, in the process of researching this book, marketing it, come into contact with people from lots of different walks of life who have an interest in dry cocktails for lots of different reasons.
Yes.
Could you take me through some of the most prevalent ones, maybe?
Well, I think there's... There, do you want to try that? That's got a little bit of rosemary in it.
I think Tom maybe should sample this, and then I'll take the Negroni afterwards.
I'm willing to throw my hat into the ring, so... Oh, and I have to say, that is... It has that... There's a slightly kind of earthy or very slightly smoky autumnal note, which takes me straight to Cocktail Town. So let's see how it drinks.
Actually, I've forgotten. Sorry, it needs a little splash of soda water on the top.
Oh, well, I must say, it's
the
already,
jury's
was it already?
I tucked in yeah, already. Sorry. I've made more room. But yeah, just for the little
withhold
comment.
Your judgment for the time being.
Take two.
We can compare and contrast the sips as well, before and after soda.
Well, I've also eaten a big old ice cube as well.
Okay, this is going.
That is absolutely delicious.
If really you were delicious. In one of your conventional socialising environments and you were served that instead of a more conventional alcoholic cocktail, would you be disappointed? If you were served it without knowing it was non-alcoholic,
well, no,
would you even know?
This is, I think, one of the interesting points. And actually, Kev, I mentioned this very briefly before you came into the studio. I think there's a sort of placebo effect with cocktails. If I were to drink that, I think I would become a little redder of face, maybe a little looser of tongue, and I would start to exhibit some of my signature inebriated behaviour. Do you find that? I mean, can you do sort of blind tests and see whether people can sort of get it?
I think so, actually. When I first was testing some of the recipes in the pub, the one that I tricked everyone with was a homemade Pimm's. Obviously, I didn't do it now because it's quite summery, but it was fantastic. So it's a mixture of sort of black tea, balsamic vinegar, ginger. And I think Pimm's taste like pop anyway. And the non-alcoholic one, I literally could not tell it. I would happily drink that.
Yeah.
And I do think the point is what you said before as well. If you arrive somewhere for dinner and it's already been made for you, you feel looked after. Mm. You feel like you're not... a pain. You know, sometimes because I live in the countryside, I'm driving, but I do want to have a glass of wine with my supper, but I don't want to drink all evening. So to be offered a cocktail at the beginning makes you feel quite special. And
I think, as you say, there's a feeling that people have been left out a bit. You literally feel left out, you know, even if it's a big event like a wedding, when it's like, oh, yes, there's some fruit juices for you and the kids over there. And
yes.
It's a bit dismissive. Well, this is a triumph. Claire, have we set the bar too high? Who knows? Shall we move on? What have you got
on
your sleeve next?
The next one is called Pomegranate Negroni. I wanted to find something that had that sort of fruity, bitter yumminess. Mm. So this is with pure pomegranate juice, about 200 mils, but you can obviously sort of play around with the amounts that you like. And the special ingredient here is cherry concentrate. So this is Montmorency cherry, which is quite expensive but lasts for a long time and is a really sour concentrate and gives you that incredible sort of nice depth.
An investment if you're going
it's
to get into this kind of thing.
It's a definite investment. And you can keep it in the fridge, you can have it warm with hot water. It's delicious.
I'm going to come back to the question I was asking before Tom really interrupted me, which was about the reasons
I've had a couple of drinks in me. I always do that.
The reasons that different groups of people might have for wanting to engage with dry cocktail making.
Well, I think there are various different groups. I mean, there's a big movement at the moment, which I don't think is a fad, about more mindful drinking. Often people want to stop drinking for various reasons, health, money. They want to clear a head, they're doing it for a charity, they're doing stopping for a bit, or they just want to be able to go out with their friends and not always feel ill the next day and eat a whole load of crap. What you do with
yeah, no, exactly. And what about these things? It's interesting, on that point, we have Dry January, which has been knocking around for a while, and then the sort of Get Sober for October, which has just finished. I think they missed a trick by not calling it Octsober.
Yeah.
But there we are. So is that a help or a hindrance, do you think, in this sort of realm? Because does that make people say, hey, this is brilliant, I'm going to get involved with the old dry cocktails during my month? Or does it cause ructions because people say, I'm just trying to get through this month and I don't want to sort of celebrate it? How does that fit
in? I actually think that they're quite good because I think so often when you stop drinking for some reason, you feel lonely and alone and you're not part of a gang going out. You know, someone goes out to the pub. Whereas with these things, I do feel that you were supported by a group. Hmm. You can still go out. You've got an excuse not to be drinking. You're not being boring or, you know, you're not given any hassle by everybody because you're doing it for a good cause. And I think it's sort of the whole thinking around not drinking needs to change and is slowly changing.
And Claire, I was slightly dancing around this point, I think, with my last question. But obviously a lot of religions require either periods of abstinence or total abstinence. That must be an important demographic for this kind of thing.
Absolutely. I know that a lot of the cocktail bars in London are starting to do much more interesting non-alcoholic drinks. And also, you know, there is an argument I have with the sort of, you know, the small country pub, which is actually we need the revenue from the alcohol, which you're not going to get if someone comes in and doesn't drink. However, you would be very happy to pay for a well-made, interesting cocktail if it meant you could sort of sit for the evening and enjoy your time with your friends.
Instead of an already invited price for a Coke, which is warm.
Exactly. Well, and if you do drink wine...
vastly superior to the sort of crap pops that you get.
Exactly. Mm. And if you do drink wine or bitter, you often don't like sweet drinks. That was my big problem. I've always been offered fruit juice and you want some more. So this, I am putting a few bitters on the top of this,
okay,
which do have a little bit of alcohol in. Well, 40% actually.
Henry, you're only a pale young man. Are you going to be able to handle that and carry on with your day of work?
Claire, we... I've been distracting you while you've been making this. Maybe you would like to tell us what you've been doing in the meantime, very skillfully, while you've been talking to us.
Right, there is, it's about 200 mils of pomegranate juice, pure pomegranate, not juice drink, which has got lots of sugar added to it, a couple of teaspoons of the cherry concentrate, a couple of good slugs of Angostura bitters, which I love, and then the last thing is a generous peel of orange, which you twist on the top so that the oils go on the top of the drink, and then put it in facing you so that as you drink, your nose will touch the orange.
Oh, there we go.
I've got quite a snub nose, but hopefully I'll be able to reach it. Thank you very much. I'm going to try to superimpose myself in my imagination into a social event, try to imagine, you know, what impact this would have in context. I'm going in. Yeah, see, that really does it. That's the ticket, isn't it? Now, I didn't manage to touch the orange peel with my nose, which makes me feel kind of bizarrely inadequate. Nonetheless, it is a delicious drink.
It's quite specific, that sort of Negroni. There's quite the sort of a tartness. It's quite, there's some potent flavours. Henry, does that take you to...
It's absolutely delicious, and I think another way in which it replicates the effect of a strong alcoholic drink is I couldn't actually just down this in the same way that I might be able to a Coke
savor,
or, you know,
exactly,
an orange. It really forces you to kind of relate to the flavours, relate to the drink in the same way that you would with a high-end alcoholic drink, and I think that's a really important aspect of the experience, because if you feel that you can just neck it,
yes,
it feels like you're going to be drinking squash almost no matter how much effort
you're
has gone
losing
into it.
All of the subtlety and the refinement.
Exactly.
And when you get the, two, sort of
the aromatic and the bitterness, and those are the sort of things that I think, you know, engage your taste.
And what were the most important ingredients there that created that effect?
Well, I think the cherry, interestingly, is very intense and very sour, but very fruity. And it reminded me of... there's sweet vermouth and also Campari are quite bitter, but they've got that very fruity, slightly orangey, herby feel to them.
Claire, time is short. Let's rattle on.
The last one.
Again, we mentioned the bar was set high.
Another one.
Then it was two from two. Yeah. How do we complete
a hat trick?
How do we complete the hat trick? What have you got for us?
This is actually a warm one. So this is a spiced apple. Obviously, coming from Somerset, I've had a lot of spiced hot ciders and apple juices. So I've pre-made this in a thermos, and I'm going to pour it in with all the spices so you can see, although you might get a mouthful of them.
I'm already excited. I can see a cinnamon stick protruding from a tumbler.
So this has got fennel. I've got a little chilli in there, which you can play with, allspice. I would say be very careful when you're spicing apple juice with the cinnamon and with the cloves. They can really overdo it. And then what's different about this...
This is going to be Christmassy, isn't it?
Christmassy.
Okay.
Well, sort of autumnal rather than Christmassy.
Okay.
And then this is buttered, so you actually put in a little teaspoon of butter, which melts on the top, which I know sounds really strange, but it gives you a little bit of savouriness.
I am getting some powerful...
God, you have this last one.
Sorry, Henry.
That's all right.
Strictly.
And obviously, this is lovely to put in a thermos, take on a walk.
Wow.
That butter's kind of emulsified on the top.
Yes.
That smells like the apple pies that my white-haired gram-grams used to make with cloves in. Just to sort of paint that picture for the listeners, if they needed it. Let's get stuck.
They didn't. What were we dealing with there?
I mean, that is sensational. It's very dry.
Yes.
Absolutely. And a long aromatic finish. That's really excellent.
There's lemon juice and orange juice in that as well, fresh, squeezed, and... I like it because it's not too sweet. However, obviously, my children always want a bit of maple syrup added into it, which
Wow. I think that may... You may have saved, Claire, the best for last, to be honest. Mm. They are absolutely delicious and sensational, and great. I feel we must wish more power to you on this enterprise. it's a requirement for the listeners to get hold of dry, non-alcoholic cocktails, cordials, and clever concoctions. They are clever, and the cleverness is born from the mind of Claire Liardet. Thank you, Claire, for coming to see us.
Thank you very much.
Autumn is here, and many will now be dusting off that essential accessory that possibly won't have seen action since midsummer, here in the UK at least, the humble umbrella.
But, Tom, people have been doing this for thousands of years. The first recorded use of an umbrella, or parasol at least, appears to date back to the pharaohs in Egypt.
And that's just one part of the story of the umbrella, which has now been compiled in a new book, the wonderfully named Broliology. Got that first time, pretty pleased. Its author, Marion Rankin, is here to tell us more. Marion, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Now, it is interesting, this is an item, an artefact, if you will, woven into practically the fabric of civilization, and yet there haven't been many exhaustive looks at this before. How did you come to this? Have you just always been fascinated by umbrellas? What's the sort of origin story, if you like, of this?
I'd been to the Rain Room in the Barbican back in 2012-13. If you haven't heard of it, it's basically a group of artists created an artificial rainstorm indoors in this gallery, and the sprinklers were highly attuned to any kind of human movement beneath them. So you could walk through this entire field of water without once getting wet. And it was quite uncanny, because it was like the experience of walking through a rainstorm with an umbrella, except that you were your own umbrella. It was really strange. And I was walking through the rain one day and just sort of musing on umbrellas and books, as I do, and a few ideas started sort of tugging at my hem. Various passages in a few books that I'd read recently that had fantastic appearances from umbrellas in them. And I thought, oh, maybe there's something here that I could explore.
I think that's pretty good as an origin story.
I think it's a good origin story. I'm interested in the origins of the title of your book, Broliology, because it is apparently a real word, not a neologism, that you've made up. And that suggests that it's a pre-existing field of study. So I'm interested in who are the greats of broliology?
Well, Charles Dickens, for one, is an absolute... I think something like over 140 umbrella mentions in his work.
Was he a student of the umbrella or just an enthusiast of the umbrella?
I think he kind of made himself into a student, to be honest. He wrote several essays on them. In one, he actually went to where they were making them at the time and sort of watched them go through all the many, many stages of putting an umbrella together, which is an extremely complex operation, particularly when you're doing it all by hand. And he wrote them into a huge number of his books and essays as well. They flit in and out of most of his works.
And how do they sort of fit in? Because I think we mentioned in the introduction, you know, the pharaohs were using a parasol. Is this a sort of product design history or is it part social history? I mean, your book obviously gets into this, but for our listeners, you give them a sense of, has the umbrella sort of moved up and down through the social strata? It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely has. I mean, it's a fascinating object because it's had so many different meanings, and that's what really drew me to it. I started the book not as a history of the umbrella, but as a collection of literary mentions. Being a massive reader, and I think you can tell it's a book kind of written by a bookseller, because I'm just sort of going, read this. These are all fantastic books, and what wonderful brollies they have in them. In kind of studying the history, I learned their various social meanings and cultural symbolisms, and it's quite extraordinary. You know, they've been associated with the lowest classes in England in the past and held over kings and rulers and chieftains in other parts of the world, so it's very varied.
Have you found brollies to be a relatively universal object across time and space? And obviously, you know, we wouldn't expect a brolly from mid-century China to resemble a contemporary English umbrella. But have some kind of implement that resembles an umbrella been used in, you know, almost across time and space over all the years that you looked at?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I love about them. They're quite timeless. You know, I think if you had a time traveller from 18th century England pop up on Charing Cross Road and saw us with our iPhones and our iPods and our earpieces and so on, they'd be completely bamboozled, but they'd know exactly what the umbrella was doing there.
Now, tell me about the most sort of unlikely locations, because you know, people would sort of ride into battle with an umbrella in hand and this sort of thing. I've always found something slightly comic about umbrellas. I don't know if it's because it's the sight of, you know, when they turn it inside out when the wind blows, or there's something sort of tragicomic about the old inside out umbrella dispatched somewhere, you know, in the roadside or stuffed into a bin. it's always struck me as a funny item. Is there great comedy in it? Or do you think, because some of these meanings are quite sort of pregnant with deep symbolism, some quite dark, very sort of cosmic things. But there's something enduringly entertaining about an umbrella, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of what kept me going through the process of writing. It was just that I couldn't quite take it entirely seriously the whole time. There's a writer called Charlie Connolly who wrote a book about the British weather called Bring Me Sunshine. He sort of laments all these umbrellas you see on the street, kind of battered, disfigured. He thinks it's a terrible insult to the amount of human creation that's gone into an umbrella. But I think they're wonderful. I actually started collecting photographs of them while I was writing the book. I just find them completely hilarious in many occasions. And there's actually a character from a 19th century play, a character called Paul Pry, who was very, very popular at the time. His signature move was to eavesdrop on his friends and relations by pretending that he'd forgotten his umbrella. So a typical line from that play would sort of go, Paul Pry going, oh, sorry, I forgot my umbrella. And someone else going, oh, plague take you and your umbrella.
Henry just leafed through to the page. We saw
Do you know what I'm interested in? You know, I'm looking at Paul Pry now and, you know, he's quite a kind of grotesque figure. And you can see that his possession of an umbrella, the way he's holding it, is quite intrinsic to him as a kind of caricature. And similarly, I'm now just looking at a page and looking at a suffragettes poster, which shows a kind of a line of suffragettes brandishing their umbrellas in the air like they're some kind of a weapon. The umbrella in these two depictions seems to be quite obvious, but I'd be interested in hearing from you, what do you see the contemporary semiotics of the umbrella to be? Because when I think about, you know, images of people holding umbrellas in the developed Western world now, for example, I'm not sure if they're as potent as signifiers. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think I would agree with you, actually. Looking back through history and the incredible force of the meanings that have attached themselves to umbrellas, I don't think they have quite the same symbolic power that they do today, which is kind of a shame in some ways because they're quite extraordinarily comic and violent and slightly terrifying and also make wonderful shields and shelters, obviously. So nowadays, I think of the modern umbrella and I honestly do see one of those sort of battered, unstrung spindles, broken kind of things you see on the street.
Taking someone's eye out on a Routemaster bus. Yeah. What's a proper umbrella? Because to my mind, it needs to be something that, you know, a gentleman or lady could wear sort of by putting the hook end over their arm and carrying it as they walk elegantly down the street. That amazing umbrella shop down on New Oxford Street, for example, something there that's been made the same way for generations. But most of the people I see these days, they've got the little tiny compact ones that you sort of buy in the chemist for £8. It seems like a waste of getting an umbrella to have one of those. Wrong? Or does every umbrella have something to offer?
Oh, I mean, they all do have a little to offer. even if it's just a gif of a pop-up umbrella losing its head on the,
yeah, that's the moment that's you try to use good. It. That's always good.
But yeah, I mean, I do think it's sad the way umbrella manufacture, along with, you know, the manufacture of so many other things, has become so very disposable and things really aren't made to last. And that's terribly wasteful. I actually found a designer who was making skirts and clothing out of broken umbrellas because they just wanted to sort of stem the tide of waste.
Sustainability,
exactly,
and reuse,
yeah,
and that kind of thing, yeah.
Some clearly caught your eye, though, because you do have a series of photographs in the book of kind of unceremoniously discarded umbrellas. What are they doing in there alongside the kind of more beautiful historical artefacts?
So they're there because while I was writing the book, I actually started an Instagram account because I was writing it during winter, which is peak time for brolly discoveries on the street, as I'm sure you know. That just kind of kept me going from day to day. Whenever I sort of tired of writing, I sort of gave myself a very strict deadlines. And whenever I was flagging it, just invariably five of them would pop up outside work one day. So that was sort of my way of keeping myself going. And some of them ended up in the book. The publishers liked them enough to include them.
Is there a favourite literary instance of an umbrella? Is there a favourite depiction in, I don't know, painting or in other forms of art that for you sort of embodies everything that you understand the umbrella? Can you choose favourites, or is it an unfair question to ask?
I think it's fair enough. There are an awful lot of them to choose between. One of the ones that I came to quite late, I'd actually written the book and then I had to sort of rework the end of one of the chapters, was this umbrella from Japanese sort of folklore and mythology, the whole family of demonic monsters in Japan. There's a subgroup of household objects that after sort of 9,900 years or so become sentient. They're called Tsukumagami. there's actually an umbrella yokai in that collection.
So this is a, let me get this right, this is a sentient, monstrous umbrella.
Yes, absolutely. Typically it's got one leg wearing with a foot and a sandal, big long oily tongue. It'll come up behind you and sort of give you a big oily lick. One or two enormous eyes, and it just bounces all around the place.
That sounds a bit like you, Henry, to be honest.
Thanks, Tom.
If you were embodied in sort of monstrous Japanese umbrella form. I mean, that sounds terrifying, but that's that would be a favourite, even though it's sounds like the stuff of nightmares to my impressionable mind.
I think it really speaks to the world today, as I was saying, with the sort of disposability of objects. It just sort of catches my imagination. So you sort of think, well, you know, what if all the things we did throw out? You know, you think of that enormous collection of rubbish just spinning in the Pacific. What if all of that did just come to life and haunt us? And in some ways it has. I mean, you know, reading about microplastics getting into the food chain and all of that is something very, very haunting and still quite relevant to that, I think.
Could you have written this book about any given object and made it as vibrant, made it as compelling? Or do you think there's something intrinsic in the brolly which makes it particularly symbolically significant? Obviously, you've done the research and been able to kind of bring to light its more compelling aspects, but could you, if you've applied yourself to any other object, lamps, for example, have done the same thing?
It's possible, but I think unlikely. As you're saying, that sort of comedic element of the umbrella, you just don't get that with a lot of other objects. I did joke at one point that I was going to write one about mops, but, you know, they
mops,
just...
they are pretty funny. I like a mop. I like a mop sight gag in some physical theatre, for example.
Sideshow Bob.
Exactly.
But they don't have such a propensity to malfunction. I think therein lies the intrinsic comic appeal, doesn't it?
They're very dignified, aren't they? Yeah. But then they can go so terribly wrong.
It's inspired stuff, and it makes for a great read. The book is Brolyology. It's out in all good bookshops now, I think, Marion, I'm right in saying?
Yes, out today.
Wonderful stuff. And our author is Marion Rankin. Marion, thanks for coming to see us.
Thanks for having me.
There you have it, Henry, the Monocle Weekly with Tom Edwards and Henry Reece Sheridan.
It was my first time. I'll never forget it.
Draws to a close. What guests we had. Fascinating to hear from them, one and all. I am going to do several things. I'm going to go to that brilliant exhibition at the SOAS Gallery, not too far from here in London. I'm also going to purchase myself a fine new umbrella, and I'm going to make myself a non-alcoholic cocktail or two to enjoy this afternoon.
You're probably going to slip some booze in there, though, aren't you? Let's be honest.
Maybe a little splash.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by Alessio Dallana, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin.
The Monocle Weekly will return at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Henry Reece Sheridan.
Goodbye, and thanks for listening.